Whoa! Calm down there. You know, guys, let's just put up our feet. You know, I don't know if you can see this.
Put your hair down.
Let's just put the shake your hair feather. This is my vibe coming into season two. I'm being told to put my feet down. So I'll clean that up. Yeah, thanks. Thank you. Sorry, serious.
Penn is getting yelled at. You can't hear it because they're behind the glass, but yelled. Yeah,
there's epic. A team.
Yeah.
Actually, it's one guy. His name's Brendan.
He's furious.
No, there's a team. They represent the beast. And we're doing their dirty work for them.
We're in the belly of the beast.
Yeah, welcome to season two. Coming to you live from the colon. It's pretty good. We can edit from there. We can go into something else. Guys, what's on topic? What's happening in the news? You guys want to get political?
No, never.
Definitely
no,
not. Never? But we are so excited to be back with you guys.
I am so happy to be back. I've missed you guys. I've missed interacting with our listeners. I've missed recording with these two folks. Mm-hmm. And I'm so happy that we're in person today.
Yeah, me
My
too.
My heart's full.
It's much better.
It's so nice. Otherwise, we're just getting into fights all the time.
Seriously.
Fight.
Conflict.
If Penn and I are fighting, Nava's yelling, fight, yeah. fight.
I'm instigating most of the... I'm spreading misinformation.
Yeah.
Whatever I can do to create toxicity between Penn and Sophie.
Because it's good for TikTok. Yeah. Toxicity is good for TikTok.
Welcome to Podcrushed. We're your hosts. I'm Penn.
I'm Nava.
And I'm Sophie. And I think we would have been your middle school besties.
Which means we're just waiting to sell you drugs. So stupid. We're not going to use that one.
Can we please move on to our guest, because we're running out of time and we're running out of attention span. We're running out of ad buyers' money. Mm-hmm. Today we've got Ed Spaliers, who is an English actor. You might know him from some of his massive shows like Downton Abbey. He played James Jimmy Kent. He's on Outlander, where he played the antagonist, the awful antagonist, I guess, Stephen Bonnet. You might know him from Aragon, which was his first role, which we get into. It was a huge franchise back in the day. I played Aragon. Also, Star Trek. He plays, I think, a role that is a bit of a similar, it's like a reveal spoiler that we can't talk about. I think this is what I recall him saying. So it's a very, very major role in Star Trek, which you'll be seeing. Most recently, Ed's talents have brought him to a role on my show, You, where he plays Reese! Reese! Yeah?
That's great.
Ed's a legend. We love having him on. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet. Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Ed, thank you for flying all the way just for this interview and putting your kids, taking them out of school.
Yeah.
I'm just stunned.
Yeah.
Well, it shows how much you mean to me, Ben.
It is really nice to see you. It's been a little bit.
It's been a while. Yeah. I mean, it hasn't been a huge amount of time, but it's funny, isn't it? Because I don't speak out of turn here, but you go and do a job where you work really intensely with someone, and sometimes you strike up great rapport, sometimes you don't. I think I've waxed lyrical about this, how much time and respect I have for you, and how much I enjoyed our process, I suppose. So genuinely I feel bowled over with honour to be sitting here with all of you today, because I know how passionate you are about all this. I know how great it is. So yeah, I'm. It's great to see you again.
Yeah,
it's
good to be here.
That might have been the best reaction we've gotten. Yeah. Bowled over with honor.
We're honored to have you.
Yeah. And I feel like, in particular, what we had to tap into and what we were doing was a really interesting and strange and almost risky process, you know. I mean, the way you played Rhys, I think, was an immense challenge. And you, mm-hmm. I mean, you more than showed up and delivered. I mean, I really do think it's like a standout performance of the whole season. You know, I mean, I'm always there doing Joe, and that is what it is. but you know what that's like. You know what that's like. You know what it's like to just have to carry the whole scene and then me get all the credit. You do all the talking. And how much talking?
I mean, he did go on a bit.
Wow. Yeah. We like to start now going back sort of as far as you're willing so that we can just put a nice context around this formative time of life, mm-hmm. adolescence. Maybe sketch us out a bit of early family life that led to the way you felt and the way that you were in middle school.
That was a formative time because the sort of school I was going to, 12, 13 is when you're about to make a change. So you're about to go into a secondary setup. For a lot of kids, it's around 11, but I happened to be at a very privileged school. However, I came from a very different background. So I think that was... I was going to school with kids who were getting picked up in the flashiest cars in the world, had all the money in the world, and I remember sometimes almost, and it's horrific to think like this, I was almost embarrassed to see how I was going to be picked up, you know, because it would be clapped out old cars sometimes and all that kind of thing. And I suppose going to a place like that, from an early age, you feel responsibility to do well in an environment like that, because I knew that my parents, for better or for worse, had found a way to put me through an education like this and sort of sacrificed many, many things and probably sacrificed things for the, you know, luxuries for themselves that I think maybe a lot of parents wouldn't these days. So I did feel pressure. I felt pressure very early on in this world to achieve. It's funny because I think I'm constantly caught between relishing that pressure and being resentful of it, because I feel it's that pressure that's constantly driving me even now.
Yeah.
Ed, I want to know a little bit more about your family life. So you said you were feeling a lot of pressure. That made me wonder, did you have siblings who were in the same position as you, or were you an only child, which could potentially make you feel even more pressure, like you're the only one in this position? What was your home life like?
So I come from one of three.
Okay.
But the complexity is we all have different dads. Mm-hmm. We were all found ourselves going to these, like, I suppose they're not the higher echelons of elite school, but they're, you know, private schools. But every single one of us had some form of scholarship or bursary to be there. Mm-hmm. It was just the decision that the parents made to make sure that was a thing. Interestingly, at that middle school age, my brother had been there prior to me, and I think he'd struggled with certain teachers, and some of those teachers were still there. So the minute I got there, they had it out for me for some reason of a pre-existing.
Yeah.
They take your place.
Are they much older?
They are a lot older.
Right.
The next one up, in fact, I was messaging him before coming in here today. He's like 10 years older than me, and then the eldest is like 17 years older than me.
Mm. Wow.
But to be fair, we've worked really hard to make sure we stay close, because I think quite often with half siblings and step siblings, it can be quite tricky to form the bond.
Yeah.
But I mean, that is, you know, one of the huge driving forces in my life is the fact that us three as brothers, we are incredibly close. Mm-hmm. And there is, of course, there's elements that don't work all the time, and there's opinions and things. But, you know, the next brother up in particular was really influential in a lot of my sort of creative outputs, and certainly when it came to music and film. And, you know, he showed me Terminator 1 when I was 5, which is probably a little bit...
I mean, these days, that's standard.
Yeah.
Honestly.
That seems a bit much.
Stranger
Let's
things.
Let's not endorse, you know, it on the podcast, but maybe wait a little longer.
I've got a lot of time and love. Well, both my brothers, but he was definitely a big shining light growing up. Because there were things that happened at home that weren't always great.
Yeah.
I have to give a lot of space to him and how he tried to protect me, nurture me, and do the big brother thing.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you say that he sort of nurtured the artist in you.
Mm.
Is he an artist? He's not, right?
He's a very creative soul, fiercely intelligent guy, much like yourself, Penn. He is he
Sorry, I give them looks.
Give them like, see, I am intelligent.
Yeah. So stupid, sorry.
I'm waiting for proof.
Yeah, he worked.
I didn't go to school, did I? Sorry.
He worked in the music industry for years, DJing, promoting things.
Oh, so that's very much in the world.
Yeah, completely.
Okay.
And he's wanted to make films for a long time, and in fact, something he's aspiring to do at the moment. But he's a very creative soul.
When did the art start speaking to you, and when did that start to become more than just like a, curiosity or hobby?
I think really early on. Mm-hmm. My mum's got some ridiculous notion that she was in an amateur dramatic play and I was pregnant with me and she felt me kicking. She was like, oh, he's going to be an actor.
Wow.
Which is a little bit far-fetched. I mean, it's a very sweet story,
or is it real? Is that exactly what happened?
You came out with jazz hands.
Yeah. A little far from the truth.
Oh,
yeah.
So bad in the world.
But I think very early on, I was given chances to do, I think any opportunity that came my way at school or a preschool to do any sort of little production, I got into it very quickly.
Mm.
And that became, talking about that age from about, I'd say that carried through until about 10. And then when I was at this particular school, I was given the chance to play Puck in Midsummer Night's Dream. Mm-hmm. I was only 10.
Yeah.
And I just remember loving the feeling of being on stage and having everyone sort of in the palm of your hand in a sense of a 10-year, however a 10-year-old can have that.
Yeah.
And enjoying that. I think it was an attention thing to start with.
As far as we're aware on Wikipedia, we did a bit of our research. Did you write a play? Because you never, I feel like we had a lot of conversation.
Can I actually read you the Wikipedia entry? We can erase this if you don't feel comfortable, but it's written in such a like tantalizing way.
Yeah,
so it says, Spilliers wrote a play that was performed at Eastbourne College in Sussex, where he attended. Extraordinarily controversial. Retribution dealt with the subject of pedophilia and was met with stunned reactions.
Stunned.
Tell us about this, Ed.
Yeah, so please, honestly.
So when you're between the age of 14 and 16, you study for something called your GCSEs in the UK. So if you do drama, you have to devise a piece. Or you can either devise your own piece or you have to do, take a written piece and sort of reenact it and everything. My friends and I, there was three of us, decided to devise a piece around paedophilia. And in particular in sort of young offenders institutions. It was kind of taken from inspiration from, there was a book and then it was turned into a film called Sleepers. Do you remember that film?
Yeah.
No.
That
Brad
movie
Pitt
was very scarring.
Yeah. And Kevin Bacon.
I do remember that movie.
Yeah. And I don't know, as a teenager, I was fascinated by that film.
It was with like priests, right?
Yeah. I think it is based on a true story. You got Robert De Niro. I mean, it's an all-star cast. Everyone's in it.
Yeah. Brad Renfro as a kid.
Brad Renfro, man.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was also, there was a Ray Winston film. I think that was what his first... His like breakout performance was in a thing called Scum, which is a different idea, but in an institution. So we thought that would be a good thing to explore, and we pretty much improvised the whole thing. And it was
improvised.
Oh, well, wow. Improvising a play about pedophilia.
Yeah. I'm not sure
yes and works there. The same way.
I mean, there's no way it would be happening in school anymore. I know, it's bad, isn't it?
What was controversial about it? Was it just that it was a taboo topic, or was the point you were making controversial?
It was quite violent. It was, I suppose, for a school exam piece.
Mm-hmm.
Like quite sexually explicit, and like it was not. Yeah, it was. We got a really good grade, though. So I mean, it was marked.
It was ambitious.
It was very ambitious. It was controversial.
So you improvised the violence and the sexuality.
Yeah, I mean, that was staged. Like that, we rehearsed that, and that was that was choreographed. And the one kid in particular, who's still a very good friend. So, he couldn't be that badly affected by what we put together. there were a few times where we were having to sort of like, there was some, oh God, I can't believe I'm saying this. There were some beatings that like didn't quite work out and like we actually hit him on the shins. But I was like, I know, but having now worked in the industry, I've worked, I mean, that kind of happens when you're.
It does.
Yeah.
We always get bruises and cuts.
Yeah.
I know.
And also like teenage kids are knocking about, always getting up to mischief. So at least we were trying to do something creative.
Yeah. Hmm. No, I think it's laudable.
Can I just ask one more question on this one? Were your parents in the audience?
I think my mum would have been, because my mum never really missed anything.
Do you remember how she reacted?
She's the best critic I've got, because she never ever puts me. I'm like, mum, you've got to be a bit more objective like than what you're doing at the moment. Like, please. Yeah. So, no, but there was a lot of, you know, a lot of our peers were, and other teachers were. And I remember them just, because it was quite a, you know, hoi polloi sort of school. Everyone was very, oh, no, it's very good. No, it's very good, Edward.
No, it's challenging. So good.
Really challenging what you did. You're pushing the boundaries, weren't you? Yeah, no.
That's so good. Okay, we'll move on from middle school in a minute, but I do want to ask a couple of questions that we always ask our guests on Podcrushed. One of them being, what were your experiences around love and heartbreak at this time?
Good question. So that, I think my interactions were quite strange. I remember I was doing a play outside of school. I was doing Bugsy Malone, nothing to do with school, like in a group production thing. And there was a girl there that I really, really, really fancied, but I could not bring my, I think maybe because I went to an all boys junior school, I just couldn't bring myself to talk to her. Mm-hmm. However, this is going to sound really creepy. However, I always had the guts to phone her up and I could phone her and like use a payphone in the school, like boarding house. And I used to put all my money into this payphone to speak to her. And I talked to her for like an hour and a half every night. Like the kids are like,
oh, that's, well, that's not creepy. You're talking. No,
it's, yeah. Maybe it's not.
Are you leaving a message, Ed?
Yeah.
In an hour and a half. Voicemail.
I haven't heard back from you yet.
I'm in a voicemail.
Yeah. Try again.
But every then, you know, we'd have
and
these
And she
great...
wouldn't talk to you either in person.
No, I think she would have.
She just, mm-hmm. No, she was silent on
I
the other
I think she
end.
Was expecting me to come up to her. She was a year older.
Yeah.
She was playing into tropes. She was playing into the idea that you need to. No.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think maybe back then. But also, I just remember being so petrified to go and talk to her, and like almost sweating in rehearsals. Mm. But then also desperately wanting to go and talk to her. I mean, that sort of So that relationship didn't last, obviously.
Yeah.
And then
sorry.
Secondary school, it changed a little bit, I suppose, because I was suddenly in an environment where there was. There was girls, there was women, they were up to 18, so it was like, it was a whole new
Did you thing. Have any notable heartbreaks?
Yeah, by someone who was a couple of years older than me. It was quite raw.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think she was still in love with one of the singing, all dancing sports heroes of the school.
The other question that we always ask our Podcrushed guests about middle school is, do you have any embarrassing stories readily available about that time?
We'll take an embarrassing story from any moment of your life if it doesn't come from middle school.
Embarrassing stories.
Yeah.
I'm not very good at. Maybe I try and push all these things away.
Yeah. Do you get embarrassed?
I get embarrassed all the time. I have a huge chip on my shoulder about many things.
Just pick one. Pick one.
No, but they're not necessarily. They're not the things that embarrass. But I thought the embarrassing thing would come up, and I was like, what have I been embarrassed by? When have I? That's bad, isn't it? That maybe I don't wear them. Wear them front and center. That I can't think of a particular memory that is making me go. Oh, that was an awful moment. I think I've had more traumatic things happen to me. Than embarrassing things.
Aww. Embarrassing is hard. It's like. It has to be kind of trivial. I mean, maybe not trivial, but it can't, you know, traumatic feels like a different
thing.
Sadder experience.
Yeah, wouldn't ask you to share your most traumatic.
That's another podcast we have.
We can come back
Crushed.
To that one.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I've got to think about embarrassing things.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. I'm sorry.
That's fine. No, so actually, to me,
Sophie's actually very relieved. She has a hard time thinking of embarrassing things, and she's you're the first person who hasn't been able to think of one. So
it's hard. They're hard to remember. They're hard to pinpoint.
I'm in good company.
Ed, we're going to get into your career in just a moment, but I wanted to ask you, your father, you mentioned when you came in, you were talking about your kids, and I just wanted to know how you feel that becoming a father has changed your life or impacted your life.
I feel that I look at the world so differently, which I'm sure that's a theme that comes up time and time again with people once they, you know, encounter parenthood. I feel that I'm so sensitive to things happening to other people. I used to be a lot more, I definitely used to be a lot more aggressive in life and even towards others as well. I feel that that has shifted. I'm certainly protective of my own, but I feel that I have a lot more empathy for the world in a way that I didn't possibly before. Mm.
Can you just share a little bit more? Because I love hearing people talk about how becoming a parent increases their creativity, mm-hmm. because sometimes we might associate it with the opposite. Can you share just a little bit more about that?
Well, I think you are only a heartbeat away from some sort of emotion spilling out of you, because children, from the moment I remember, both my son and my daughter, both of them when they were born, just the emotion that poured out, having seen this, witnessed this process, and witnessed what my girlfriend was able to do. Hmm. You're like, how on earth is that possible? And then that emotion never leaves you. What? I mean, don't get me wrong. It also means my anger emotions are also just like, also simmering right as well. Like, my daughter's a firecracker and she keeps me on my toes at all times. I feel that your personal emotions, your own emotions are just at your fingertips so much more because you're, I don't know if it's your, it has to come down to love. Yeah. I just watch these two, and they are fulfilling that all the time. They are they're my driving force. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They are the reason that they're the reason I'm sat here talking today. All these things. It's not about me anymore.
I just want to highlight something you said because I haven't quite heard it this way, and I think it's really profound. You connected creativity to love, like the expression, greater expressions of creativity being connected to greater feelings of love. And I just want to put a highlight on that because that's beautiful.
Nava summarizes things actually with she'll draw out the genius in what you just said.
I mean, I've never heard me a genius put in the paper, but I'm going to take it for that one.
I think it's really lovely also what you said about how your children have increased your empathy and how you feel about other people. I don't have any children yet, but my sister has a daughter and she's pregnant with a second, and she has told me that, before she loved kids, she would see children in public and think like, oh, cute, like most of us do. But then after starting to raise her child and seeing, the progression, the challenges that she goes through, all of the emotions that she experiences, her little idiosyncrasies and little cute things. Now when she sees another child in public, she just has this like overflowing love because it's not just a child sitting on the bus next to her. Like she imagines that whole spectrum of that child's life. And I think that probably extends to other human beings as well because everyone was a child at one point,
That's how I feel about dogs after getting a dog. But anyway,
well, so
it's true. Every time I see a dog, I'm like, God, you're so special.
So I had it with dogs for years. I still get it with dogs. Yeah. But I think you can have that. I think it's just putting on someone.
Well, what you were tapping into there, Sophie, is I think like we should feel that kind of love for all people. Yeah. I mean, we really, like honestly, like when we see somebody who doesn't have a home and is forced to live on the streets, when we see somebody struggling with addiction, when we see somebody really in any kind of pain that is notable, it should break our hearts at least a little bit. And I feel like the future of humanity is in the kind of love that we're able to tap into now with parenthood. I think all people, of course, have access to that. It's just so that we know it's like becoming a parent is like a fail-safe way.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And even then, by the way, lots of people it might crack them for a second, but then they wall up after. So,
That's true.
But it's a love that's universally available to all of us. How about that?
Wow, there we go. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
With my busy life, I use Shipt same-day delivery to keep up. When I need a jar of extra creamy peanut butter delivered, I know my personal shopper Amber will come through. And if it's not on the shelf, she asks them to check the back. Shipt, delight in every delivery. Learn more at Shipt.com.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Was your first role in Aragon? All right, moving on. Thank you for coming.
No.
So wait a second. So what were you, like 17?
17, yeah.
And
it shows.
Well,
it's your first role. What a major role.
Yeah, it's huge. It is huge. I also want to tell you, I went out for that. I auditioned for it.
You'd have been a lot better.
I don't think so. No, you know what the feedback from the casting director was to my agent, and I've never gotten this before or after in my life. And it was warranted, but it also shows how long I'd already been doing it. And I was like, I was not remotely prepared. I was like, this is a story about a dragon. Little did I know how popular dragons were going to become.
Yeah. Was the feedback pen, put the cigarettes away next time you go into an audition?
They're like, don't put them out on your own arm.
Yeah.
It's a little disconcerting.
No. Freaked everyone out.
No. I also knew, by the way, I had a whole diatribe to my girlfriend before. I was like, it's going to go to some British guy.
Really?
British guy I love. I just probably gave one of the worst auditions in my life, least prepared, and the feedback that the casting director gave, I don't know what the tone was, if it was admonishing, or if it was, she said he was so unprepared it seemed arrogant.
Arrogant.
Was it arrogant or arrogant? Do I have a chance?
Did I get it? Are you saying I get it? Arrogance work? It's all a facade. I'm miserable. Yeah. So that was. And in fact, I didn't even recall that until I saw that you were Aragon. I was like, wait, is this the same Aragon?
Yeah.
So arrogant.
It must be the same Aragon. So that's cool.
Yeah. And again, this comes back to being at the that sort of down at Eastbourne and being at school where I was given opportunities. So every time I was about to sort of veer off the straight and narrow, or if I did veer off the straight and narrow, I had this very pushy drama teacher. I also had this sort of personal tutor there who they just ground me in doing like a production. They'd always constantly have me doing something that was, like creatively stimulating.
That's great.
It was really cool. And one particular teacher, the head of drama, who was an actor himself, he kept putting me forward, because he had connections to the industry, he kept putting me forward for film auditions. And there'd been two or three, like the Narnia series was one franchise I went up for, got quite close on that. And then, not close enough, but anyway. And then I think the Hannibal Rising was another one as well. And then this audition came up, and I remember doing like two tapes, and I was all set to be like going on a rugby tour to Argentina with my school. So that's what I thought I was doing. And my dad, even to this day, is still like, well, you should have been going on a rugby tour. That's what you were supposed to be doing.
And I mean, to be fair, you sound like you were very cool. You've never mentioned that you played rugby. Like,
yeah,
that
that's an embarrassing story in itself.
All right. He only gets better.
Ed's embarrassing story is like being too good at two things.
I literally am golden. Yeah. I shine everywhere, and it becomes embarrassing.
Embarrassing for you guys. That's what I
mean. Yeah. I mean, I'm embarrassed for all of you at the moment. Yeah. I'm going to just keep dropping those in there as well. Yes, this, and it came up, and it was a completely surreal scenario. It was the one thing I'd wanted more than anything, but suddenly I was going to be like sent off to Eastern Europe for 7 months. As a 17-year-old. And it was weird because I was at that age where I wasn't young enough to where a chaperone was required.
Mm. Yeah.
But I wasn't quite old. So I wasn't quite old enough so they could do like full like adult hours kind of thing. So I was in this weird, limbo where I was basically given free rein.
And in Eastern Europe.
In Eastern Europe. As a guy who was already a little
golden rugby player.
Well, No. There'd be a few friends at school who would definitely be scoffing at that right now.
Yeah. No, I'm sure.
But I was already a kid that was, I don't know, sometimes I found myself getting in trouble at school. And so to take that kid and put them in Eastern Europe with complete free reign and liberty...
On a film set,
on a film set, when you're surrounded by people who are quite liberal in their approach to life, anyway,
and you're number one on the call sheet, probably.
It opened up a whole
giant
new way
franchise.
Of living life.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy that free reign, or did it feel like too much?
I enjoyed it at the time, but hindsight, what a wonderful thing it is, has made me realize I was given it too much. Mm-hmm. And I remember actually having a chat with my dad in a square in Budapest, and there was a load of crew there. My dad's not an emotional man, although there's elements of him that are becoming more so as he gets older, but he looked scared, and he told me he was scared.
Before you went off?
As I was just starting. And I'd never had sort of seen him so honest about it. And as a 17-year-old, unfortunately, I wasn't prepared, and I wasn't emotionally mature enough to handle that. I kind of just laughed it off and be like, oh, Dad, you know, it's fine, you know, and took a very rock and roll approach. And I wish I'd heeded his fear a little bit more.
What was he? I mean, I think it's kind of clear broadly, but what was he afraid of specifically in that moment for you?
I think he was afraid that I was going to be swept up into the TV film industry and potentially spat back out again. He was right. He was definitely right. I think he was worried that I would be doing all the wrong things, you know, the drinking, the things that, you know, the temptation that is put before you when you're, well, at many ages, but certainly as a young actor and you're starting out. And don't get me wrong, I took the work very seriously even then, but I didn't have any grounding.
Right, yeah. Well, you were 17 in a film set with no real parameters. No.
It's a $100 million movie. There's nothing. It's pretty, and it's like, you're,
and that was when, by the way, that was like, franchises were not as common as they are.
No.
That's true,
like this really, that was a big, that was why I was so unprepared for my audition. I was like, I'm not going to get this thing. No, but seriously, I mean, that was like, I just want to appreciate that. That was not... There are a lot more people who can relate now to that experience. I said, still a small number, but more people. Then I did feel like it was just not really a thing.
And I wonder if now, if people have, there's much more of a support network that is enforced. Yeah. And I feel that, you know, I think both my parents just felt like they didn't know what they were supposed to do. And it's not their fault. And also, I was supposed to have this one of these tutors I was talking about at my school come out and like keep my education up. That just went completely. So having been like going okay with certain things at school, that was just forgotten about. And It was a huge opportunity. I got to work with some amazing people and the actual experience of making the film was amazing. Was mind blowing, but I also struggled with it because it was really poorly received. And when you're 17 and front and center,
first role,
and I was completely taken apart. The film was taken apart. I was taken apart.
Jeez, that just seems.
Just an aside, cool. I have so many issues with the way that critics write reviews because there's human beings at the center, and sometimes it feels like they're deliberately, to get their views or whatever, they're like deliberately being like mean and like cruel in the assessments, and it's just so unnecessary, especially if there's a child, like someone under 18 involved. There should be laws against that.
And especially in film and TV where there are so many hands in what's being created and actually so little control belongs to one person alone.
So true.
And so what ends up happening is that the actors get skewered, I feel, because they're the face of the project. But yeah, it just feels quite cruel.
Yeah.
So, Ed, what was it like to be skewered at 17?
No.
I'm kidding.
I mean, in all honesty, I was still... You talk about us on set, and it comes back down to this thing of pressure. I mean, there was huge pressure there, but then I completely went off the rails on the back of it, and I was I'd basically kissed my career goodbye by the time I was 21, more or less.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, I was all over the place.
So how did you get back in? Was Downton Abbey the next commercial project?
That would be the next commercial project, but I feel there were two independent films that did before that that just put a bit of confidence back in. And it was about finding discipline, I suppose. I think a discipline is something I'd struggled with for a long time. I found a lot of it through running, weirdly, and I discovered that even more so on a couple of these independent films. I just ran every day, and it's very meditative for me, and which I know so many people say, but it's been a big turning point, I suppose.
Do you still run?
Yeah, I still do quite a lot. Not as much as I was. I was doing huge amounts during COVID, and like distances. This is another embarrassing moment.
It's not another, it's the first.
Yeah. He's about to brag.
The reverse of thing.
So you're saying you're an incredible runner. You ran 17 miles a day. Yeah, sure. And also not running.
Yeah. But that became part of it. And I think, so these two little independent films I did where I just enjoyed the process and got back on and actually felt like it was the first time since probably being at school I had confidence in my ability. And then Downton did come along. And that changed it yet again, I suppose.
Yeah, I would assume that, like, projects, like getting Downton Abbey, for example, that can, you know, feel affirming in one way as an artist. But then on the other hand, being able to do more independent projects that have less of an audience that aren't tied to how they'll be received as much, where you can just focus on the art and the reason that you probably got into it, the feeling that you have, the joy that you have when you're doing the art, are probably both necessary.
I think they definitely are. I feel that, and also you sort of can't really do one without doing the other anyway.
Yeah.
But, and actually on Downton, as much as it was commercially huge success, and I had some great things to do in that show, I was also very much, it was a good big, that was another learning curve, because it was a place where I got to watch a lot. Hmm. Rather than, I wasn't front and center, which is fine, but it was a place to absorb and study other people and how they responded. But I think, definitely that you need both, because one gives you the confidence to do the other as well, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Is one of these films, again, we did a little tidbit of research, is this Wale?
To Wale is something I produced.
Oh, okay.
We should talk. Yeah.
It's worked on. It doesn't say started.
Right. Okay. So hang on.
It's a short film.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right. Let me read the rest of this question then.
Yeah. Just another one of my talents, you know, Pet.
Okay, do you think you could produce one of our projects? So from what I'm reading is that it centers on racial prejudices in the UK?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, it does. It's a very good friend of mine, Barnaby Blackburn, who he's written and directed, and I've produced with him 3 shorts. This was the first. It centres around a young guy played by the wonderful Raphael Famitobe. I feel like I'm doing a pitch for it, even though we've...
I'm so sorry. Well, you're going to have to do this, always, to support your craft.
He is just coming out of a Young Offenders Institute, having done some time, and he's trying to rebuild his life. And it's exploring how difficult it is to do that in London, in inner city London, and the prejudices that people face. So he comes back out to be he's trained as a mechanic, and he comes back out to be a mobile mechanic, and he meets this character who he thinks is going to be his first client and might even potentially be this sort of, almost like an angel, just someone who's going to look after him and guide him. And it turns out that guy is there to just exploit him racially, essentially. Mm. So we wanted to look, we've shot that 5 years ago now, 6 years ago maybe. So it was a time when there's understandably a lot of attention and a lot of heat in London, about racial discrimination, exploitation. And we just thought it was an important story to mm-hmm. tell.
I would love to hear a little bit, sort of what, from your perspective, what are the biggest challenges facing achieving like total racial equality in a place like London?
The polarizing views are becoming so extreme now. It feels like we're just going back in time, and I don't understand why. I don't see why everyone's had to fight so hard for it. I just can't see the logic of how anybody thinks that's a good approach. And I think what my fear is that, certainly in inner cities, I suppose, that if you come from a certain racial background, that you're going to struggle because there isn't the attention on where you are. There isn't the investment on where you are, and I feel that people are going to suffer as a result. And I don't know why, but why can't we make it better? I don't know why we can't fight. I don't know. I just don't get the logic. I don't see why.
Well, the question is so hard to address, but it does feel to me like because we're addressing the problem as a primarily material crisis, whereas the crisis is invisible. The things that are withholding us from progress are not material. They're for the three of us hosting this show, we would refer to them as spiritual, but you could refer to them as moral, philosophical, political, somewhere in that realm. Because the things that are, the barriers in our way is not like, oh, there's not enough money to fill in the blank, nor is there not enough time to fill in the blank. It's just about will, So to me, although I don't have an adequate answer to that great question, it's at least that we seem to be attacking these problems as though money will solve the problem, actually. You know, because again, for all of the incredible work that countless organizers like around the world in different ways are doing, like there's no doubt about that. Like there does need to be redistribution of wealth. There does need to be the generation of wealth in different communities. Like absolutely. It's of course like material well-being is one aspect that needs to be addressed. But without tapping the root of the problem, which is ultimately like actually an idea, like race as a social construct is an idea. Yeah. And it's like, you know, we're not. Yeah. So I don't know.
Yeah. I also think it starts quite young. Like what we were talking about earlier, that overflowing love that every person has the potential to tap into for other human beings. Mm. I think part of the reason we don't have that, especially for people who don't look like us, is it starts at school, like at a very mm-hmm. young age, especially in the U.S. Yeah, at home or, you know, most schools in the U.S. are quite segregated, not, you know, by law, but by neighborhood. And so if people aren't living in integrated neighborhoods, then they're going to schools in they're going to segregated schools, essentially. And they're growing up surrounded by other people who look like them and not getting to know and developing a love for a whole range of people.
It's interesting because we're having breakfast yesterday. My son, he's a fascinating little chap, and he's got questions on everything.
Yeah.
And I don't have the brain power to answer him coherently, but I try. And he was asking me, yes, what is it? He said to me yesterday, we were talking about religion because he's studying something about Greek mythology at the moment. And then we moved on to religion and it was that whole sort of BC AD thing. And then he was talking about religion in the UK and like Christianity being quite prominent. I said, yes, it is, although I think it's starting to shift and Christianity in the UK is waning. And I think you might have to fact check me on this, but I feel like Islam is actually the more prominent faith in the UK.
Cool.
And he was like, why? But why, Dad? But and I was trying to explain to him, since the beginning of time, we have been a country full of people immigrating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is forever evolving. And I was trying to explain to him that Christianity has been the strongest standpoint for such a religion for such a long time, the main faith there. But it's evolving because we've had so many different people coming from all around the world with their cultural ideas, with their faiths, mm-hmm. with their feelings, and coming in there. And I think it's great that it's evolving. And if Islam becomes a more prominent one for the next 400 years, then so be it. That's mm-hmm. that's cool. But if it's bringing in, you know, us saying that these people have, you know, if it's, you know, a couple of generations ago, a family have arrived, and then that next generation, they're British, and they are feeding that in. And Britain has founded itself on being this melting pot of ideas and faiths mm-hmm. and beliefs. And I think that's pretty cool. So I feel that sort of taps into,
mm-hmm.
I think, sort of what you're saying, Sophie, in terms of where people, you know, where people come in, what they're surrounded by.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just quite curious to think my 8-year-old son was asking me the question, and I still don't think I gave him a good enough answer, because he looked at me and he was like, oh, he didn't. He looked unsure.
Yeah.
I think our political systems and our educational systems, like basically all the systems through which we organize ourselves, are cast in the light of old beliefs about human beings, that some were better than others. You know, like basically caste systems everywhere,
mm-hmm.
some formal, some informal. But basically the belief that some human beings are better than others and deserve more than others. And hopefully that is an antiquated view, and we are moving more and more towards the enlightened understanding that that's not true and that there's like essential oneness. But our systems absolutely do not reflect that and then actually reinforce these old beliefs so that there are some that still hold them. So if you think about like an institution as a channel through which resources flow, those channels are definitely broken. Like what you're saying is right. They don't get to some places. Some places get way more than they need. So we also just like have to have new political systems and reform all of these systems to be in the light of the like understanding of oneness. And until we do that, we won't have material solutions. We won't have spiritual solutions. It is inaccessible until you change systems to be really built in that light and in that understanding.
In a way, we've complicated things beyond any kind of reason.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And there is an inherent oneness to humanity that we all actually as children just feel and know, you know, before we've learned about race, before we've, you know, all these differences that some are real, but some are magnified and some are just totally imagined. And so I feel like one of the greatest challenges of being a parent is like kind of taking all that you know, all the complications about the world that you know are sort of set up to obfuscate this, some of these simple truths and just be like, you know, like, how do I say this to you right now? How do I say this to you in a way that you'll understand that doesn't actually start to teach you about all of these unreal complications? You know, is that what I'm saying making sense?
Completely. Yeah, well, completely. Because the other question he asked me the other day was what we were talking about. So my beloved football team in London is Tottenham Hotspur.
Yes, I know.
And one of our star players, who is like possibly the loveliest man in men's football,
Son?
Heung-min Son.
Yeah,
who came on and scored a great goal against West Ham the other day, was subject to racial abuse, and I'm like, Asia and my girlfriend and I were like, just like, how is anyone racially abusing these people? Like these people, and it's every team is doing it. Every fans group, well, most group of fans try not to, but there's certain fans that seem to do it more than others. And we were talking about it in the car, and my boy Jude was like, but Dad, what's racism? And like I tried to explain, and he just looked at me, he was like, well, why? Like what? How is anybody like prejudging, and where's that based? So,
but that's incredible that an 8-year-old is so enlightened that it's absurd to him.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
That's also beautiful.
It is.
It's amazing.
That we're at that stage. Yeah.
But and it's such a shame that we have to have everything so affected as we go on in life. So, how do we reset it? I know it's a huge thing, but how? Yeah.
We're going to figure that out today. Yeah.
Different podcast, though. That's it's going to be on our RSS feed. You guys tune in. YouTube, like and subscribe. We'll be solving racism there.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix. Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match 2 of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
I want to actually move us on to you, to talking about you, the project that you guys worked on together. No, not you. But you.
Let's go from race
to
Netflix's number 3 show right now.
Really?
I don't know. By the time this airs, who knows?
I want to jump into you. How did the role of Reese come onto your radar?
So I was out here filming something else at the time. And my UK agent, Rebecca, is obsessed with the show.
Oh, really?
Obsessed. I think she's delighted I'm here today.
Hi, Rebecca.
Maybe we could call her Beck.
Wow. There we go. Hello, Beck.
She basically said she dropped me if I didn't do it. But she was like, I was like, I have been working, Rebecca.
like me, you're like,
I'm on Star Trek, Rebecca.
she made it pretty clear. She's like, I think this would be a really great, move. And I was like, okay, well, I'll do some digging. I'll do some research. Oh dear.
Everyone got on this show more.
And I mean, to be honest, it felt like I had to do it based on what... You don't often get full scripts when you tape or audition. You probably don't know what taping or auditioning is, and you probably haven't done it for 20-odd years.
What else have I done? What else have I done that leads you to believe that?
But so often you don't really... You seldom get a script. So if you get sides, it's so hard to work out what this part's all about unless you...
Yeah. So true. It says like literally boy or girl or man or woman.
You could take it in any direction.
And you've got no context. You don't know where this fits in the story.
They don't give you the name of the thing. Like I remember when you're auditioning for something like Spider-Man or Star Wars, they will not give it the same name. They won't tell you the role. They won't tell you the plot.
Is that what happened when you auditioned for Mr. Fantastic?
It's what happened when I auditioned for Aragorn, actually, which is why I...
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, as an actor, it's frustrating. It's like, you're giving me nothing.
Why did
and
they do that?
And it's also, by the way, usually a false scene is written specifically just for the purpose of the audition. So it's like, so it's a little bit denuded of substance. And so it's just like, I'm trying to do what you want me to do.
Yeah.
And they give you a huge casting breakdown of describing a part of it, almost throwing every characteristic out there.
Yeah, because you just don't really know what's going on. And they want to be like, so you want to be giving it this, but also this, and also but under there, a little bit of this. And then on top, you're sprinkling a little bit of this. And you're like, okay, all right, I think I can.
But just throw it away.
You're too invested. Just
pull back just a little bit.
We want you more arrogant. That was too arrogant.
Get out. but the reason why I was so hooked straight away is the scenes were so well written and so thought out, and I got a really good understanding of who this person is, and I was keen to get involved. I then did a Zoom meeting, which is a Zoom screen test. It's the weirdest thing in the world because I was sat in a tiny room, and I got the sense it was about 50 people online. I couldn't see any of them. Apart from John Scott, I think I could see.
Ah, shout out to John Scott.
Shout out to John Scott.
Intrepid producing director for season 4. Mm.
And, I mean, that seemed to go well. And then I had a lovely lengthy chat with Sarah Gamble, and she gave me the whole précis of what was going to be taking place for the part.
Okay, so that's what we were going to ask you next, probably, was, I think, right? When did you find out about, like, Reese's true nature?
She basically told me everything. Mm-hmm. And I bricked it because I was like, how on earth am I going to, there was that pressure thing coming in again. I was like, how am I going to do that? How am I going to deliver? How am I going to find a way through to make this believable? Mm-hmm. I suppose it's very different if all you've known is this show, but when you come into something that's such a juggernaut and has such like global viral following with so many voices and opinions of what people like about it, what characters people respond to. Mm. Inherently, you cannot escape that in the prep process. And I know we talked quite a lot about where this storyline will sit and how people will respond to things later on down the line. And I think actually what's happening at the moment, now the first part is out there, it's kind of playing out how we discussed. It's like people, I think, are a little bit like, people seem to be really enjoying it, but also going, what on earth is going on?
Think about the twist that everybody thinks is the major reveal, which is that Reese is a figment of Joe's imagination, or at least that the Reese who's killing people is. Mm-hmm. That's the end of episode 7. Mm-hmm. You still got 8, 9, 10.
Yeah, you still got
you
some
still
punchy
got
stuff.
The Cage, which is a huge reveal. Mm-hmm.
Still got your directorial debut.
Which is a major revelation.
We
want
to talk about that too briefly,
And you've got the bridge, you've got everything. So to me, I think the fact that people
your reflection
have,
in the mirror, the final shot. Yeah.
Do we know what's going on there? Do we know anything more
about season 5?
Yeah.
Can neither confirm nor deny. No, actually, I have no idea. I literally have no idea. I actually don't. I mean,
he's backtracked so well on that one, isn't he?
Is season 5? Everyone wants you back.
I mean, my personal feeling is that the writers have a major decision to make, which is like, is Reese along for the ride? Because it's a big decision either way.
Yeah.
Remember how hard it was on our schedule to shoot scenes where you are both there and not there, but there and not there. I mean, it actually made shooting everything. It was like we didn't have a lot of the time. It was a phenomenal lift to do justice to how Reese needed to be appearing and I think but then if he's of course not there, it's like, well, so what does that mean? I mean, I think they have a major decision before them with Kate as well, like is she evil, is she, you know,
which avenue do you pursue?
The reason I'm so easily able to say I have no idea is because I think the writers are short of an official season 5 confirmation. They just have to have the vapor, the cloud forming in their mind. But they, you know, they're not.
You were basically three characters in one. There was the Reese Montrose, who was the mayoral candidate, who we saw giving speeches. There was the Reese author, who would, you know, chat with Jonathan Moore, get to know him, share similarities, and then there was Reese,
murderous,
the alter ego of Joe. And actually, the scene in episode 7, at the end of episode 7, where we realize that Penn has just castrated Reese Montrose mayoral candidate.
Joe.
Oh, Penn. Yeah. Is it Penn?
Joe has castrated.
It's so hard to tell you guys Reese. Apart. Yeah. So much in common.
That's the first time that, you know, there's two of you, your two characters in one scene. And that was phenomenal. That was mm-hmm. incredible. Seeing you play Reese after we already know about the evil Reese, you know, you realize that those are two completely different characters. Mm-hmm.
Although Sophie, to be fair.
Yeah, at first, thought, when you showed up in your suit, I thought, oh, he has a twin brother. I figured it out. But yeah, can you tell us a little bit more about your process? How did you do that?
I mean, that was probably that particular day.
Ooh, that was a day.
Was probably one of the hardest of the shoot, but also, yeah. Again, because I like pressure, I'm probably so into
castration.
Yeah. As a personal
was that,
hobby
was that
of
actually
mine.
Borrowed from Retribution?
Make me feel like I'm just
back to my scene, high school days.
Make me feel like a little
and
boy.
I've got an idea.
It's beat you by the shin, mate.
This has been done once before, but it went really well.
It was
I passed my exam.
Yeah. So.
it's a funny one because I remember leading up to that process, leading up to the day, it being, I was so fraught with concerns about how to deliver and how to execute that part because the advantage of once the cat's out of the bag, I've really felt quite passionate about, as much as there was always a lot of dialogue to get my head around, which I actually really enjoyed doing that. I really liked the muscular nature of Reese's vocabulary. Once the cat was out of the bag, I felt that it was this huge liberty, and it was like a liberation. I felt incredibly free in the process, which actually meant the final few episodes, although there was a lot to think about, I just felt I was able to explore and play. But in that moment, it's weird because I hadn't really had much of playing the real Reese.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
It's true, actually.
Yeah. There's only three scenes, real, yeah. And one of them is he's getting his balls chopped off. So,
yeah.
I mean...
Yeah, but what a scene.
Or zip-tied off, actually, sorry. You know, let's get it right.
Yeah. Finished off.
Finished off, yeah. But prior to that, there was only, like, two other scenes.
Yeah.
Maybe three? No, two. I think there's literally two scenes. And anyway, so he was trying to get the real version of him sort of mapped out was quite tricky, but I also didn't feel I had to put too much difference because it wasn't until later on in the series, once the revelation comes up, that this whole new side of Reese comes out, because actually the Reese you see communicating early on with Joe Jonathan is very in tune with the real Reese, I suppose.
I guess
the difficulty was actually how to place myself mentally in that state of being tortured.
Mm-hmm.
And what that would be like, and what things I could find, you know, substitutions could I find in my own life, you know, what power of imagination I could use.
Mm-hmm.
And I will probably wax lyrical about this chap again, because I have to say what I loved about our process for months, right? And you get it right from the off. You know when you're in a scene with someone and you're like, oh, no, this is going to be a good experience. Because Penn will always offer moments of levity and humor in day to day life.
He does.
Right?
He's really good at that.
Because he's a fiercely intelligent.
I'm waiting for proof.
No, but because I just felt that we had a really strong respect. That's what I felt anyway, for one another and what one another was trying to do. And actually, we just trusted each other. So when you get to a scene like that, it all comes down to trust.
Mm-hmm.
And he's so great to act against. It's not a minimum requirement because that's lazy and I don't think that's true, but you do, if you offer yourself over to someone who's going for it, inherently something's going to work, something's going to happen. And I was pretty invested in the story as well. I just felt there was something very powerful about these two. And it was turning, I don't know, I feel it's turned what the show has been on its head a bit.
Yeah,
well.
It does. Absolutely.
No, absolutely. I mean, and I think that we've understood since season two that kind of needs to happen in some manner every way. So when I was pitched this, the barest bones concept of this sort of partnership
between Joe and this like entity, you know, that was like, I was like, that's probably the best way to take it. Mm-hmm. And then when we started working together, I was really excited because of how invested you were in well, what were you just saying? You're just like, you actually kind of made it fun, I think, in a way. Like, it made Joe fun, which is really important, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, it because if we're able to have fun, that means the audience is seeing something different in Joe that, honestly, I mean, you only got shades of with 40, played by James Scully in season two, which was another like a moment of an iconic pair. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, we have a few of them throughout the series, like just people that are great. You got to pair Joe with somebody he can really go head to head with. And it was such a joy. Those last three episodes in my memory were just so much fun. And then I was also prepping to direct, so it was like just the insane schedule. So to me, the first seven episodes are of a different, completely different like universe for mm-hmm. me than the last mm-hmm. three, where we got to be a duo in that way. And just, and yeah, I don't know, I just remember just you in your suit and just like, just diving in and chewing up those monologues, and every take you were different. I mean, every take you were different. We were always trying to figure it out, and I just think it was brilliant.
It was so fun to watch. I have to say, it was fun to watch men.
It was fun to watch men.
It's so great to watch men.
Yeah.
So fun to
That's
watch.
Another podcast.
To watch, we've got three. Now.
That's a good name for a podcast.
Okay. Men.
Fun to watch men.
Yeah, that's a good name.
No visuals. just the podcast.
So you were a character named Stephen Bonnet on a show called Outlander that was uniquely cruel to its two protagonists. I've never seen a show put the two leads through so much. And I was just wondering, when you have to play heavy characters like that, how do you get out of that mindset?
I think it's impossible for it not to weigh on a little bit. Certainly some of the subject matter that Stephen Bonnet was a part of in Outlander, yeah, you it's hard to escape that. And I mean, it's something that sexual violence is, it's again, coming back to having children and in particular a daughter, and that didn't sit well with me. And it's hard to decipher between what is telling the right thing narratively, what is actually a really, are we achieving anything creatively from mm-hmm. here? And I think as long as it's justified creatively, I can get on with it. But it does sit with me. I think I enjoy playing villainous mm-hmm. parts. I think I certainly strive, maybe, and then particularly with Reese, for them not to be too like pantomime-esque. I fear that sometimes they can be, and I've definitely been guilty of maybe them being that way, but I feel that with Reese, I really didn't want that. I really wanted it to be this area of grey, because, you know, that's humanity, really. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're pushed to extremes. But also, like, I mean, like Reese was a lot of fun to play. Mm-hmm. And we talk about confidence earlier on. I feel I get a lot more from playing those types of people, because I like trying to. I'm fascinated by trying to understand human behaviour and what makes people tick, and also what's led people to be a certain way. It's tricky with Reese, because obviously that version of Reese is a manifestation. But yeah, if you ground him in what information I was given about him and the real version, I've just always been, I'm drawn to those characters, I suppose. But they do, you do, there's always parts that are left, you know, lingering within you, I think. Mm. You have to, I mean, look, I guess also the advantage of this show, which I don't want me to do it a disservice to the right team or anything like that, I just feel that although the issues it tackles head on are quite heinous, there's some pretty heinous acts take place, I feel, and this is why I think it's so popular, it's done in a way that allows levity, and it allows the audience the chance to go, I mean, this is really completely twisted and messed up and beyond belief.
It's bananas, yeah.
Yeah.
It is, totally.
However, we can get on board, we can go, no, it's safe, because it is so bananas, and it is, I feel there's a tongue-in-cheek element sometimes.
There absolutely is. And that's what I mean. I think your role was exceptionally difficult to find that balance.
Yeah.
You know, I really do. And I think you did an iconic job. So I just want to commend you for that.
Thank you.
That's the final.
Yeah, yeah. A real left turn here.
Back to middle school, because we're on a show called Podcrushed.
Or it doesn't have to be say. What would you, if you could visit your 12-year-old self again, what would you do?
I would say, trust yourself. Believe in yourself more. Don't worry so much. I still say that to my nearly 35-year-old self as well. Because I think those... It's interesting. I know, obviously, the topic of conversation is that, you know, age group, but I feel that... I feel if someone had said that... I mean, and don't get me wrong, people did say it to me along the way, but I feel if I'd really believed in those things.
Yeah, that's... Mm-hmm. I think the question is evolving to become, like, how does that person hear you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think if those messages had got through to me clearly...
Yeah.
Then I would look at the... Look at myself differently. I maybe appreciate myself a bit more. I think I constantly have that battle of putting on a front of backing myself and having a swagger around me. But you know, you know, within it's not. And I think, yeah, I think just to trust yourself and believe yourself a bit more, believe in yourself more. Not worry about others as well. In the same way, I know we talked about empathy earlier on. I'm rambling. I'm always rambling. I'm so sorry.
No.
Well, we got to wrap it up now.
You truly are a pens match.
Yeah.
Just get those editing scissors
in
there.
Yeah, we'll just... There was a full stop there at some point.
It's great. Ed, you've been so delightful.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for flying me out here.
Yeah.
Of course.
First class.
Time away from your family. Now let's make a TikTok.
Yeah, let's make a TikTok.
Let's make two.
Two TikToks.
One TikTok. It's not even like... She's like, this is not even a joke. We're making two.
Two. Okay. You can catch Ed on Star Trek Picard Season 3 out on Paramount Plus or on You Season 4 out on Netflix.
Yay!
And you can follow him on Instagram at Edward J. Spaliers.
So I've just worked out my embarrassing story, and it's from today. Whether this is usable, whether you think it's too much. I think I've just done that whole interview with my flies down, because I literally, unless they fell down during whilst we were doing the TikTok bit, but that's highly embarrassing as I'm saying goodbye to everybody. I noticed it, and my awkwardness and insecurity rose to the fore. So that was good. Stitcher.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.